This is the Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. This week, Bill and Phil discuss the ways that the Epstein case is turning Trump's supporters against him, and then dig into the curious and troubling phenomenon of American political institutions ceding power to the presidency. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Bill Muck, and I'm a professor of political science at North Central College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Phil Barker, who's a professor of political science at Keene State College. Hey, Phil, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill. How are you?
Our listeners may or may not know this. Phil has been traveling in Alaska and exploring the tundra. And it's wonderful to have you back in civilized society now.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm happy to be back or not, but Alaska was great. It's just beautiful. Like it takes a special type of person to live in Alaska, I think, but yeah. I feel like maybe I could be that special type of person. Although you would probably point out that I would get, mauled by a moose in a week, but it would be a good week until that happened.
100%, right? Yeah, Alaska, when we were in Alaska, my experience was that it was a lot of people running away from other things, right? There were a lot of people, I commented to you earlier, like there's a lot of people from Wisconsin who were like fleeing maybe legal things or, you're just kind of, you're trying to get away. When you're trying to get away from stuff, Alaska is a wonderful place to go. And again, yeah, you're right. Beauty, like you never see. It's amazing up there. Yeah. It's, everything's so big.
Yeah. Yeah, one of our guides was talking. We were talking about. She was a younger woman, and she was talking about how the ratio of men to women in Alaska is way off. Right, there's like way more men. But that she was also pointing out that a significant portion of the men are also criminals. So it makes dating an interesting experience, which I thought was telling.
So if you're in a little bit of trouble, a nice place to explore is Alaska, right? That's, better than Hawaii. Hawaii will lock you up. Alaska will let you roam. So I mentioned to you, the other thing you missed when you were away was that somebody hacked into Elmo's account. Twitter account was posting all sorts of anti-Semitic and hateful things. And Elmo had to apologize for that. So, it was a very consequential week while you were gone.
A lot happening. Are we sure that it was a hack or is that just Elmo's excuse for a rough few days that he had?
Elmo just snapped, right? Elmo had enough. So, I don't know. We live in weird, weird political times. So, again, the other major story, where two things we're going to talk about today are Jeffrey Epstein and that whole story, how it's grabbing hold of our politics, and then thinking about the ways in which our democratic institutions, the courts and the Congress and the legislature are giving this additional power to Trump. So we got a lot of big, big things to kick around today.
It's a good sign for the health of your democracy when those are the two stories that we are focusing on this week, right?
Right. And we have sort of been intentional about avoiding conspiracy theories, right? There are a lot of people that talk about conspiracy theories, and we have avoided that. But this Jeffrey Epstein thing has become so mainstream and so central to our political system, we got to explore it. So it is really, really bizarre. But before we do so, remind everybody how they can stay connected with us.
Yeah, you can go to thepoliticslab.com, and you can find all our old episodes, information on Bill and I, on the podcast, all of that stuff. But also click on this week's episode link, and there are relevant articles. So there's a couple of articles about the Epstein scandal, really about the sort of conspiratorial nature of it and how that is working against Trump. But also I've got three articles from three different sources, from The Atlantic, New York Times, Washington Post, on issues regarding the second topic, about the Supreme Court ceding power, about Congress being willing to let the president sort of run over them, et cetera. So if you want to read a little bit more about what we talk about today, you can find all of that on this week's link on thepoliticslab.com.
All righty. Well, I guess all of this Epstein stuff started, maybe a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. I'm trying to remember when exactly it began. But the Trump administration released a memo in which it said that there is no Epstein file. There's no list. And that Jeffrey Epstein killed himself, so he was not murdered. And there would be no additional information released. And the Trump administration said, nothing to see here. Let's move on. And that created a wave of reaction on the right among many of Trump supporters who have for years have turned to the Trump administration and people in that administration for those conspiracy theory nuggets. People who were elected on the promise of releasing these documents, whose whole political career has been about amplifying conspiracy theories. And And Phil, they were a little troubled when the Trump administration said, you know, there's not actually anything here. We're just going to move on. So you've been following all of this from a cruise ship. But what's your sort of initial reaction to this sort of wonderfully bizarre story?
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, I think it's fascinating it's fascinating on the surface level. I mean, there's been a couple of articles this week that have talked about the weird thing about the Epstein conspiracy theory is that there's, you know, it's not so far out in left. There's weird stuff about the Epstein case, right? Like missing files and missing tape, and he died in mysterious circumstances, and he's implicated with powerful people. And so there's like more sort of substance to it than a lot of times you see. So it's kind of interesting in and of itself, but really, I mean, the fascinating part for me are, like you were saying, the political dynamics, to see how this is playing out differently. So for so many issues, Trump is able, he has built his political career largely on conspiracy theories, right? Whether it is that the election was stolen, whether it's there is the deep state, where, and it wasn't just Trump. Like I think he tapped into this vein that has been in the sort of conservative movement for a long time, right? I remember as a kid here, you know, listening to when my dad would listen to Rush Limbaugh on the radio, like all these, you know, conspiracy theories about how the Clintons were having people killed and stuff like that. Right. So this goes back for a long time. Oh, right? There's been this element, but Trump has brought it mainstream and made it sort of central to this Republican Party identity. The difference is he's always been able to sort of, I don't know, harness those in a way that just empowers him. And he was always been able to sort of move on when they are no longer useful. And this one has played out differently, in that he's ready to move on. And the base for the kind of the first time is saying no. And in fact, if you move on, it's, you know, it says something about you, right? You're a part of the deep state and whatnot. That's a little surprising to me, right? We've had this debate and this discussion for a long time about whether or not, you know, will Trump's base essentially just, has he destroyed truth to the extent that his base will just take whatever? But I think what he's done is he's created this sort of conspiratorial mindset in politics, and now he's falling victim to it.
Yes.
But maybe properly so. I mean, we should talk a little bit about his defense and why he's doing this. But I mean, what are your initial thoughts as you look at how this is playing out right now?
Yeah, a couple things sort of jump to mind right away. One is that this is, most of our politics seems to be liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. Like, that's the nature of the fight. That's not the nature of this fight. For the most part, the Democrats are on the sideline watching this fight play out between Trump and his administration and his base saying that no, this is not over. Like, you need to release these files. This is incredibly important to the movement, to the MAGA movement, right? You're seeing, you know, mainstream, but I mean, well, I guess mainstream far right news outlets saying this is central. You have to do this, and you can't just pretend that there's nothing there. And that's really fascinating to see that divide within the far right movement between Trump and his base. How he addresses that. Usually Trump just simply responds to the will of the base, right? He's very good at reading what they need and, you know, whatever. Okay, I'll give you more conspiracy theories and we'll do more anti-immigration stuff. He sort of understands where that movement is and responds. And for some reason, as you were sort of suggesting in your previous comment, he's not willing to do that now, which I think is also sort of interesting because he is not traditionally the voice of reason to say, like, well, there's no evidence here, right? I mean, clearly Epstein killed himself. There's not a massive client list. There's nothing to see here. There's nothing to release. And that we don't want to release files that could re-traumatize the victims, right? I mean, he's not the guy that does that stuff. So that's interesting to see that divide play out within the far right. I think that for me, that's really, really interesting. And it's unknown how that's going to play out, right? I'm shocked that Trump hasn't just said, okay, let's release everything that we've got. And then again, it raises this question, why won't he do that? Because in general, he is not principled. He is responsive to sort of the angry mob on the right. So I think that is, again, it's sort of wonderful movie watching, eating your popcorn on the sideline.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think to sort of build on that, the weird split here, you talked about, like, this isn't a Republican Democratic split. This is it is, you know, really that split within the Republican Party we've talked about, which is really the kind of populist wing. booming, which if we're talking about the reshaping of American politics, right? And we've talked a little bit about this over the last couple of months about how really there's this global kind of populist movement. We talked about whether or not does, you know, how do the Democrats tap into that? How do they make use of that in a constructive and democratic way? This is where Donald Trump's taking a stand against the populist element, right? So the populist element is basically saying, and this is what the MAGA movement was originally built on, this argument or this belief or this idea that the elites are, you know, pulling the strings and they're working against the everyman. And that was at the heart of this Epstein story, right? It fits into that mindset really easily, that there are powerful people. I think for most of them, they were thinking of the Clintons or whatever. So there are these powerful people who have connections. And then all this weird fishy stuff happens, and that's like you also have, you know, powerful people in institutions and all of that working to kind of cover things up. And so the populist notion is this idea of like open it all up, right? Like that we're speaking for the little people, and suddenly, and that's what Trump has been arguing. I mean, it's important to point out, like, he is the one who promised to release all of the Epstein file stuff, right? So he started this fire and got it going. And now suddenly he's the one who's now standing on the side defending, you know, this is maybe the only time he's defending institutions and elites or whatever. But I think that's where, again, back to like Trump has no principles. The only principle he has is self-interest, right? And so that's where you get into, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but it's like you were saying, like you start getting into this, like people in his administration have come out and said, there's nothing to see. There's no evidence. He died normally. That's not what Trump is saying, though. Trump has like gone to this, like, this is a Democrat hoax. Like, he's not trying to say there's nothing there. He's putting together this. He's trying to discredit whatever is there, right? He's like trying to say this is the Democrats who are doing this. And maybe it's just that he's stupid, or he's not playing this right, or that's how he always tends to go, or that's what's worked in the past. But it sure looks like, rather than just saying here, there's nothing there, he's trying to sort of build an argument for why it should never be released. And even if it gets out, you can't believe anything that's in it. That's not a good look.
And that's such an important distinction, right? The initial memo that came out basically said what you said. Hey, there's nothing here. There's nothing else to be released. All the evidence suggests that Jeffrey Epstein, you know, committed suicide, and there's not this long list. There's just nothing to do with this, which is what governments do all the time, right? They say like, hey, there are conspiracy theories out there, but once you get inside government, you realize that they tend to just be that, conspiracy theories, and the government does a pretty good job prosecuting things, and there's probably not much more there. That's what the government said. But then now he's saying like, well, there is something, but it's generated by AI and the Democrats and Comey and Biden and Obama, which is like so ludicrous, this idea that, I mean, why not just say that there's nothing here, right? We've looked through it. We thought there was maybe something there. And once we put eyes on it, there was nothing to release.
And what's amazing is like what makes it look even more guilty or desperate is that he has also, it's not just that this is something that the Bidens did. It's that if you believe it or support it, you're stupid and you're not one of my fault. Like he's like attacking his own base. I actually have a little a clip of him talking about it. Actually a fairly long clip, but let me play it because it's kind of worth listening to, I think.
But I do want to ask you to clarify something you said this morning. You said this was all a hoax. Has your attorney general told you this was a hoax? What evidence have you seen?
No, it's not the attorney general. No, I know it's a hoax. It's started by Democrats. It's been run by the Democrats for 4 years. You had Christopher Wray and these characters and Comey before him. And it's a bad group. It started, actually, look at the Steele dossier. That turned out to be a total hoax. The 51 agents, the intelligence, so-called intelligence agents, it was a hoax. It's all been a big hoax. It's perpetrated by the Democrats. And some stupid Republicans and foolish Republicans fall into the net. And so they try and do the Democrats' work. The Democrats are good for nothing other than these hoaxes. They're bad for policy. They're bad for picking candidates that can get elected. Like in New York, we have a communist running. He may get elected too, actually, but he'll destroy the city. I call it the Epstein hoax. It takes a lot of time and effort. Instead of talking about the great achievements we've had, a great gentleman. Yesterday, as you know, went on CNBC and he made the statement that Trump may go down as the greatest president of all in the United States. And instead of talking about the things we've achieved, we've had tremendous achievement. They're wasting their time with a guy who obviously had some very serious problems, who died 3-4 years ago. I'd rather talk about the success we have with the economy, the best we've ever had, and all of the things we've done, including the Middle East. I mean, you see it. Instead, they want to talk about the Epstein hoax. And the sad part is it's people that are really doing the Democrats' work.
So that was, it was nice and clear in my headphones. I'm realizing that my little lines were very low. Hopefully you can pump the volume up in
post. Yeah, I think we'll hear. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the whole classic, hey, don't look over there, look over, you know, look over here, not there right. defense. Yes. It's not a great defense.
Well, and what's really fascinating about listening to him talk, who he's blaming. So he blamed two Republican FBI directors, mm-hmm. James Comey and Christopher Wray, appointed by Republicans, appointed by one of them, appointed by Donald Trump. Then he also, you know, he's been going after Biden and going after Barack Obama, that all these individuals would conspire to create this Epstein list, this false hoax, and then have multiple opportunities across multiple elections to release that and not do so. You know, it sort of defies logic, and it comes back to your first question: why is he doing this? Why it doesn't make a ton of sense. If you're smart, you want this story to go away. You don't try to pull it in another direction. And what we're seeing from his base is they're not buying it. I mean, they're pushing back. Some of those, you know, the podcasters and the far right voices are saying this. We see this as garbage, and they're pushing back against Trump, not Democrats. It's his own supporters.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is where you fall victim to. When you engage in conspiracy theories and sever the truth from anything in politics, it's one of those where my initial thought is he has no scruples, right? So like, why not just come up with a fake report and release it, right? So let's assume the worst and he's in the report. You just remove that part and then release it. When you've like sort of fed the base this conspiracy stuff, I don't think he could come out and say, look, it's a clean case. And I don't think they would believe him, right? Like it's at the point where he needs to produce something that actually incriminates high ranking figures in order for his base to actually be appeased in any way. Do you think, is this something that like will... The question I have is like, it feels different right now, but like, if we come back to this in like 2 weeks, will people have moved on? Or is this like the sort of fringe figures, you know, online and in the party who are important enough, even if they're kind of crazy, are they going to keep this alive? Are they going to turn on Trump over this? Because they're sort of acting like it at this point.
Well, and this is the really interesting test case to see whether Donald Trump, Teflon Don, can actually, a negative story can stick to him. Because you're right, they tried to make it go away. And apparently Trump put calls out to a number of like Charlie Kirk and some of these other individuals. And like for a day, they're like, okay, let's move on. But then I'm sure all of the listeners reached out to those individuals and said, we want to keep talking about it. So we'll see. It is entirely possible a week from now, Trump has, you know, flipped reality or done something to change the conversation. But unlike any other story, Trump's had some terrible negative stories. He's always been able to get past them. This seems to have legs and seems to be sticking. So we'll see. I don't think it's going to bring him down, but it is really extraordinary to see that there are some issues, you know, that the base stands on principle, even if those principles are conspiratorial, right? They're demanding that, like, you know, you do what you say you're going to do. And I don't know. It's really, really, really fascinating. I mean, today, Nick Fuentes, who is this like far right Nazi, right? I mean, he's openly says he believes in sort of Nazism. He's the guy that was invited to Trump's Mar-a-Lago house a couple of years ago. He came out and is just shredding Trump for this decision. When you've lost the Nazis, I think you're in a little bit of trouble here. So I don't know. What do you think? Do you think this will Trump be able to move on, or do you think this sticks for a while?
I don't know. I mean, my tendency is to think that like when I think of his base, right, I think of like the average person who's going out, the people who I was on a cruise with last week, right? Like the types of people, you know, the sort of, the boomers who are big Trump supporters and whatever. I think, you know, they're not there. If Trump says move on, I think they would largely move on.
Yeah.
I don't like the sort of crazy, the sort of extremists who have been sort of a big proponents of Trump all along, but who play a bit an important role in sort of shaping that kind of conservative and far right thinking, yeah. Right? Whatever, the Steve Bannons and the Laura Loomers and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and all of that.
Yeah.
I don't know that they're going to move on as quickly because they are weirdly principled about, they were in some cases around before Trump, right? Like they were the ones who were sort of planting the seeds of this movement and then attached themselves to Trump when he came along. And so I don't see them moving on, but the question is then, who sort of wins out in that battle? Because I think that some of those figures are really significant in sort of shaping a lot of particularly the online dialogue around stuff. And so if that's the case, this isn't going to go away. Like you said, I can't imagine it like actually bringing him down. I don't know what the long-term implications of it would be, but it does feel like it's not just going to just fade away as easily as some other things.
It would be truly extraordinary if a candidate who launches himself to the presidency based on mistruths and conspiracy theory is then brought down by those same conspiracy theories. I mean, it's sort of interesting how you can live and die by the same sort of ideology. And I know we need to move on, but one real sort of quick thing to think about here is like, this is not the only conspiracy theory topic that's been in the news this week. And what hasn't got hardly any attention is that they released a whole new trove of JFK files. And one of the really interesting things that came out in that is that one of these documents shows that the CIA had made contact with Oswald before, you know, the actual assassination of JFK. And for decades, the CIA has denied having any contact with Oswald beforehand. Now, I still tend to believe the evidence is that
the CIA did it.
No, slow down. I still think the evidence, it just suggests that there was some contact. So apparently Oswald, who was dealing with some pro-Castro groups, changed his mind and then was leaning towards anti-Castro groups and then had some contact with the CIA. And it's a sort of a complicated dynamic. But for decades, the CIA covered that up and downplayed it. And that actually came out. We learned something really, really interesting. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about Epstein, right? And and I think part of why all those documents were released is probably because Trump wants to distract from the news. Let's put some more JFK stuff out there. Let's tell the people that I'm going to put real sugar and coke again. I mean, he's doing everything he can to try to get the conversation off Epstein. And he's not been particularly successful in any of it.
That's going to work, the whole real sugar thing. That's going to distract people from the Epstein scandal.
It's what the people want, Phil. I did see something else that said that it would be terrible for U.S. farmers.
Of course,
if
the reason
we went away
corn
from
syrup is used in Coke is because in America is because corn syrup is we produce tons of it. Yeah.
So he's just so all over the place. So I'm not somebody who really enjoys conspiracy theories, but this one has been really interesting to watch, and we'll see what it does to Trump itself. I don't know, any other final thoughts on that, Phil?
No, I mean I would love to be able to fast forward sort of 30 years and look at what you know sociological research and what learns about, there's been lots of research on conspiracy theories, but to see kind of how all this plays out and to see him start to kind of fall victim to his own conspiracies is kind of amazing. I mean, looking back on it, the idea that he would choose this conspiracy to sort of champion is kind of insane in the first place, but when he has well-established connections with Jeffrey Epstein himself.
Yes.
But I don't know where it will go, but I think it's a really interesting moment in kind of understanding conspiracy movements and their relation to the sort of populist leaders.
That's right. And again, you were hinting at it there, like it's entirely possible or maybe even likely that Trump is named in some of these documents. And if we're thinking about why is he being so principled about not releasing it, I mean, that is the most logical explanation.
Yep.
Right. Oxum razor. Right. I mean, so we'll see. I mean, I don't know. You're right. I think this is likely to be around for another couple of weeks at least. So we'll see.
Well, should we move on to our second topic?
Let's do it.
So the other thing we are playing around with is, you know, there's been a series of news stories, maybe none of them in and of themselves massive, but there's been a huge, I mean, I think all, they are significant. They yeah. should be more yes. significant than the Epstein thing. We're seeing something that we knew was going to happen that was a part of Trump's political movement for a long time, but maybe in more troubling ways than ever before. And that is, to some extent, the consolidation of power around the presidency, but related to that, and maybe even more concerning, is the sort of acquiescence of other institutions in this. So just a couple of stories to throw out. I mean, one of which is that we've seen a whole slew of Supreme Court cases come out that have sided with the Trump administration. Oftentimes, almost always, in ways that further the president's power and in ways that differ from kind of precedent. So there was some writing this week about the Trump won a case a few days ago that allows him to move ahead with firing people in the Department of Education, State Department, and whatnot. And historically, the longstanding precedent is you leave status quo in place yeah. while these questions are being considered. And what the Supreme Court ruled in this shadow docket case, without really any explanation, was that Trump can go ahead and fire all these people while we're figuring out whether it's legal or not. So yeah. just bizarre, but it just gives huge amounts of power to the president. And that's just one case. There's been a whole series of cases like this dating certainly back to whether or not he's immune from prosecution. That's a big one. But at the same time, we see a Congress that is increasingly willing to basically follow the president's lead. You saw that in the passage of the budget bill, where there were lots of Republicans who disagreed with it, who yeah. recognized that it was bad for the economy, but still went along with it. You sent me an article on, you know, the one thing that's kind of flown under the radar, I think, is the TikTok ban, where Congress yes. has passed a law saying that TikTok must be sold. And Trump has basically just come out and said, yeah, I'm not going to enforce that. And he's instructed the Justice Department not to enforce yeah. it. That is in both of those cases, whether it's the Department of Education, whether it's the TikTok, those are congressionally passed laws, congressionally created institutions that the president in his job has sworn to uphold and enforce. And instead, he's just picking and choosing what he's willing to enforce. And there's not massive congressional pushback. The Supreme Court's not striking this down. The court has now, I guess that's the other case. The court has, and it's not just that they're not pushing back against the presidency. They're limiting their own power to do that. Yes. So the court, yes. you know, the big case was ruling that courts can't, you know, put in place these nationwide injunctions. So yeah. they're giving Trump power, but they're giving the presidency power in ways that are going to have ramifications for decades, right? So that's a lot of stuff I threw out there, but like, what sure. do you think when you're looking at what's happening? We knew yeah. the presidency has been getting stronger for decades. This feels different, and it feels even more, I mean, far more concerning to me than what we've seen in the past. But where do you go when you first start thinking about this?
Well, let's start with that last point that you made, right? So over the last, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years, what we've seen is the growing power of the presidency. And people talk about like a pendulum that swings back and forth. And there are times when Congress reasserts itself, and then there are times when the presidency is stronger. But what we've really seen is basically post-Bill Clinton, the presidency has grown more and more powerful. And some of that begins with George W. Bush in the aftermath of 9/11, where he exerted a lot of presidential power, this whole idea of the unitary executive theory that the president in some ways is the most powerful of the three branches. But that's very different from what we're seeing today. And again, all presidents do this to some degree. You know, George W. Bush expands presidential powers. Barack Obama comes into office. He doesn't give them back, right? Presidents keep those powers and they slowly accrue. So the presidency has more power than some of these other branches. But to your point, what we've witnessed in this second Trump presidency is unlike anything we've seen. And not just in the terms of the power grabs of the president himself, the president of the United States saying like, hey, if I do it, it's law, right? Think about, you know, quoting Napoleon and all of those sort of things, but also saying like, hey, I know there's a law that says TikTok can't operate here, but I'm gonna say that's not true, and I'm gonna tell companies that they don't have to worry about that. Openly violating the law, and most of us are looking the other way because most of us like TikTok, and we're like, okay, it's no big deal. But then, to your point, these other branches, the judiciary and Congress, also saying, sure, we're gonna play ball and we're gonna give you more power. The Constitution is very clear that the tariff power, the tax power, resides with the legislative branch. Congress has basically said, Trump, you can do whatever you want with tariffs. You have total power to increase and decrease tariffs. We're not going to touch you on that, even if it means we're going to throw the U.S. economy off a ledge, right? We're willing to say that that's a power that you have. The Supreme Court, and you mentioned the cases on immunity, to say the president can do whatever he wants as long as it falls within his constitutional powers. And no smaller courts can carry out an injunction against the president if he does something blatantly illegal. And also, what was the other case you talked about?
Basically the dismantling of congressionally created institutions.
Yes. So when Congress passes a law creating an institution, and I think another thing we might throw in there is Trump is once again talking about firing the Fed chair.
Yep.
Like, and all of these things that are outside of what we would consider presidential power, Congress is saying it's okay. The Supreme Court conservative supermajority is saying, like, well, there's nothing really to see here. It's to your point, it's an extraordinary power grab.
The strike against Iran, claiming the authorization on the use of military force dating back to September 11th, right? I mean, just all of this stuff is, it's the president. And it's not that the part that is shocking is, like you said, it's nothing new for presidents to push the limits of their power. What's new is to watch these other institutions not in any way push back, in particular in situations where the president is infringing on their constitutional powers.
Yes.
Right. It's one of those things where if Congress and the president were in line on certain policies, they might be willing to sort of, but you, what you would expect is the Congress would pass some piece of legislation that would empower the president to do so. So Congress maybe would repeal the law banning TikTok or whatever, right? Go with the president on this, but they're not doing that. And that's the part that's weird, is that you talked about how all presidents do this, and they do, but the assumption has always been, I think, that institutions are self-interested. So, yes, the president wants to expand its power, but the Supreme Court also wants to expand its power and have a bigger say in things. And Congress wants to expand. And we see this in bureaucracies, right, where there's infighting between different branches of the military over who gets to do what and whatever, because there you see it, you know, between the State Department and the Defense Department on whether diplomacy should go before, you know, the use of force. And that all sort of keeps things in check in theory, right? And what we have now is the president saying, no, I want to do all of this stuff. And the Supreme Court saying, yes, we want to give you our power and let you do whatever you want. And that's the part that's bizarre. And it feels so incredibly short-sighted for an institution that is supposed to be taking the long view on things. it's really remarkable.
Yes. Especially at a moment when you have a president looking to abuse that power.
Yes.
I mean, the founders created this system, which you and I have talked about, is in many ways a very inefficient system, but they created that system to prevent these type of abuses. And in the moment when the abuse is taking place, they're all turning away and saying, there's nothing to see here. I mean, if to go back to the George W. Bush case again, you know, in the post 9/11 world, when they engaged in conduct that exceeded the law, the Supreme Court slapped them down, you know, with five or six major rulings that said what the Bush administration has done is unconstitutional. You got to stop doing it. You know, you have to give people, you know, rights, and you can't just say that there's a legal loophole where nobody has access to U.S. courts, and you have to give them fair treatment. Even the Congress, when Bush was engaging in intense interrogation, the Congress passed a law that says you can't torture. We're seeing none of that. We're seeing none of that, of these institutions pushing back to say, in these moments of excess, we're going to rein you in. And it's extraordinary. Why do you think that's the case? What is it about this moment where these institutions are willingly giving up their own power to Donald Trump? I find it really, really bizarre.
It is bizarre. I mean, that's, you talked about how in an era of, you know, where the president has made it clear that he's planning to abuse power, if anything, this is a great, if you really were a Supreme Court first person, right? If you love the Supreme Court and you want the Supreme Court to play an important role in American politics, this is a golden opportunity to actually expand the importance and influence of the Supreme Court, right? Like, this is a moment where we're going to actually step in repeatedly and say, we are going to limit your ability to do this. So to see them, and again, there's the Thomases and Alitos or whatever of the world aren't necessarily, it's not as shocking because of their sort of worldview, which I think is not constitutionally based at all. It's this weird part, or they've become sort of wrapped up in the partisan craziness of it. But it is really sort of strange to see the Roberts and the Amy Coney Barretts and the Gorsuches, some of the ones that are sort of more libertarian or whatever, to see them not do it. And I don't know if it's the result of it's again, my tendency is to think if we could have this same crisis in month whatever, 8 of the first Trump administration, I feel like the Supreme Court would be, even this makeup of the Supreme Court would be slapping him down. I feel like it's an example of this sort of weariness, the constant pushing, and it is also coming after 10 years of Trump essentially singling out and destroying people who stand up to him, right? Destroying institutions and people. We've heard members of Congress talk about how they live in fear of not of like getting tweeted at by the president, but of the president's followers showing up and doing harm to them, right? So I think some of this probably plays into it, but it's also, 10 years of again, people who were not on board with Trump early on, who after listening to him and the shifts in Fox News and everything else have sort of come to believe the crazy stuff that he puts out there. You would just like to believe that you had more Jerome Powells, who has pushed back explicitly when the Trump has attacked the Fed and talked about, right? Like he has no right to fire me. And, maybe Trump will try to do that. It will bring down the American economy if he does. But you would hope that there would be that much principle or more. Do you think the fact that it's we're talking about hundreds of members of Congress and 9 Supreme Court justices, does that make it easier for them to, sort of disappear or hide behind the decisions, right? Like I'm not sure why, if there's some sort of collective action problem at play here.
It's easier to explain away the Congress, right? Because they're all individually self-interested. They're less institution driven than they are re-election driven, right? So the moderate Republican will go along with Trumpism because it'll keep them in power, right? And so that I can kind of understand. It's still spineless, but it makes sense. It's self-interested. The Supreme Court is a more interesting one, right? Where these people have life tenure. They could make a mark to say like, hey, we believe in a strong presidency, but this goes too far, right? And that you don't have total immunity, and there's got to be some way to stop a president when they engage in illegal behavior. And that, I think, as you were poking at, was sort of the more interesting dynamic. And I do wonder whether this sort of hyper-partisan environment that all of these justices have been involved in, they're not immune to it, has caused them to conflate their conservative legal philosophy with partisan politics, right? That they can't separate those anymore. And that they think what they're doing is actually principled, originalism. But is that really originalism anymore? Or is originalism just sort of partisanship that's been framed to be legal doctrine? And I wonder about that because, Joe Biden tried to relieve, college debt, right? And the Supreme Court slaps him down. A president doesn't have the power to do that. But then Trump comes into office and says, I want to get rid of the State Department or I should say USAID and the Education Department and fire thousands of people. And the Supreme Court's like, well, it's presidential power. They can do what they want, right? I mean, how do you square those two decisions? Like the president can't relieve some debt, but totally has the power to fire tens of thousands of people and upend the U.S. education system, even though it was congressionally mandated, right? I can't square those things.
Yeah, I mean, there's without a doubt hypocrisy involved in this, right? You had talked about before we started recording, was it Alito who's like, so the court has been issuing all of these shadow docket, decisions and more than essentially ever before. And was it Alito that was asked about it?
Yeah.
And
he gave a speech talking about it. Yeah.
Right. Just happened. sometimes. But again, like, you know,
yeah.
You and I were talking about before we started recording, if it were Barack Obama and a liberal court that was continually without explanation siding on his behalf in these sort of, you know, behind the scenes decisions, yeah. Alito's mind would be melting, right? He would be furious. Yeah, and so there, but I think all of that, you and I have talked a lot about like originalism as well and the problems with originalism. And I feel like ultimately constitutional originalism was you had a political idea that they went out and found a legal justification for, right? And so I don't feel like it was like the legal principle that said we have to do it. It was that, hey, we're conservative, and so this argument, it helps us sort of stop stuff from happening that we don't like. And what we're seeing now when you have this populist movement come in, it's just making that sort of the flimsy facade even more like apparently flimsy. Like, it's just so clear that it's a farce, right? That now they're somehow coming up with these originalists who are putting together a king, which was like, if ever there was an original argument, right?
Right,
it was
right.
A check on power. And so, I mean, I think it just reveals that how do they do this? They do this because it was always politically motivated, right? It was always political motivation, and they found a legal argument to support their political principles. And so now they're doing it again, but they're doing it in this, like, rather than this long arc, they're doing it sort of week to week, and the political motivations change each week, depending on what case comes up, because there isn't an originalist argument for any of this.
Well, and the danger of all of this, especially as we think about the court system, is we can look at other examples around the world where courts simply became a rubber stamp for the president, right? You go to, Russia has a version of Supreme Court that just rubber stamps. Venezuela, yeah. We see this over and over again. Hungary, right? Where these courts simply acknowledge whatever the whims and wills of the supreme leader, you know, the president or prime minister is. And that's the danger here, that you lose your independence. And I get the short-term thinking in all of this, right? That, you know, oh, hey, this is just good originalism. But at the end of the day, you're no longer going to be relevant. And if you start to push back against the president at this point, they become so powerful, then they remove you, right? That's what ultimately you see. You saw this in Poland and Hungary and in Russia and Venezuela, where they just got rid of those Supreme Court justices that didn't support the president's perspective or prerogative. It's a slippery slope to a semi-authoritarian system.
It is the short-sighted nature of it, I think, because I think these are all things that the conservative movement has been worked up about for a really long time, you know, liberal courts stepping in to prevent a judge from a president from doing something. The education department has been a target of the conservative movement for 50 years or whatever. Yeah. Like these are all classic conservative things, but in order to sort of achieve those goals, what the court's having to do is to create a dictator, right? And it's like, it's so short-sighted in that you're going to like, yes, you're going to be able to do away with the education department, but in the process, you are also going to be doing away with democracy.
and it
feels like they are somehow unable to, or they've been so focused for so long on getting the education department that they're blinded to what they're having to do along with it to get that, to achieve that goal.
Well, and in the second Obama term, Obama passed, or in pass, he signed a whole bunch of executive orders. And one of the biggest criticisms on the right, and specifically from the legal community, the conservative legal community, was that the president doesn't have the power to pass all of these executive orders. It's completely patently unconstitutional. And now we're seeing the flip of that, where these same scholars are saying, no, it's okay that we have an imperial presidency. They can do all of these things. And then the court enables them by saying that the few mechanisms we have to slow this president down, they no longer have the power to do so. And it's only the Supreme Court that can determine whether the president is engaged in unjust or unconstitutional conduct. It's again, we're in an extraordinary moment, and it's so bizarre to see institutions willingly giving up their own power.
Yeah. It's not good news, Bill.
No, it's not. It's fascinating to study, but it really is. It's bad, bad for democracy. So I've gotten the point now when people ask me, I say that we are, you know, we're no longer a full functioning democracy, right? We are a, what's Levitsky and Ziblatt's term? I always forget that. We are a...
Are they competitive authoritarianism? Hybrid
competitive
regime?
Authoritarianism, right? That we have drifted into that type of category, right? Where we still have elections. It's still possible for the opposition to win. But what we are seeing is that the majority in power is is tweaking the rules, the institutions in their favor. And it's hard to deny anymore because those institutions, those checks and balances are now reinforcing the presidency. And it's going to be more difficult to have any type of pushback against this president.
Yay.
So. Yeah, yeah. So, good place to wrap up. Phil, why don't you remind, because now everybody's going to want to go read more about this. Why don't you remind them how they can stay connected?
Yeah, so go to thepoliticslab.com and click on this week's episode link. And yeah, there's, I think, 5 articles, a couple about the Epstein stuff, but 3 or 4 on some of these troubling trends in presidential power. So all of that is at thepoliticslab.com.
That is wonderful. All right, Phil, I will see you next week.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.